It's Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Gene Purcell, filling in today for Rob Ferret. You're with us on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Coming up on Central Time, we'll talk about a possible blackout of this weekend's Green Bay Packer playoff game.
But first, we're talking about tax breaks. On Tuesday, Congress let 55 tax breaks expire, just as they do every year. Some experts say this creates a climate of uncertainty for businesses and organizations who are the beneficiaries of these tax breaks.
Here to talk about how these tax breaks work and why they are renewed from year to year is Robertson Williams. He is the Saul Price Fellow at the Nonpartisan Tax Policy Center. And Bob, welcome to Central Time.
Good afternoon, Gene. Glad to be with you.
Well, it is good to have you here and help explain some of these things. Now, let's start with the basics and these tax breaks in the first place. As I understand it, these are tax breaks that sort of started at a period of time, not necessarily related to each other, but all wind up expiring at the same time. How did they all wind up here?
Well, Congress over the years has added bits and pieces to our tax code for one reason or another. They want to encourage energy conservation. They want to encourage businesses to invest. They want to allow taxpayers to deduct more things on their income tax. But they're put in piecemeal over time and given short-term lives so they don't cost as much for the budgetary purposes. Congress is trying to balance the budget to keep the debt from rising. And if they pass these pieces of legislation for a year at a time, it doesn't look as big on the budget calculations. In fact, if you do renew them over time, they do cost a lot. But the way they count budgets here in Washington, it's a lot better to pass them one year at a time than to pass them and make them permanent.
And politically, I would think it might be an easier sell, too. Say, well, look, it's just going to expire in 2 years, and then you'll have another opportunity to decide whether it's still worth having.
I think that's part of the equation, yes.
So who all is affected by this? I was reading a couple of articles on this, and it really runs the waterfront here. RUM rebates to Puerto Rico and the Virgin Islands, renewable energy credits, as you mentioned, film producers, teachers who buy classroom supplies. I mean, it really is all over the map.
It is. A number of them are for individuals that we'll see on our income tax returns, but not until we file them in the spring of 2015, the 2014 taxes. A lot of them affect businesses, some very small. If you raise racehorses, for example, or you own a NASCAR racetrack, you get special benefits. As you say, energy conservation. And it's just across the board. Congress has added some of these when the economy was in deep recession to help stimulate the economy and get things going again. Part of it was to help boost the housing market. One of the provisions that's expired is allowing people who sell their homes below the amount they owe the banks to not pay tax on the money the bank didn't charge them. It's the discharge loan, as they call it. Technically, that's income as far as the IRS is concerned, but to help families in distress in this time with all the bad housing market, Congress said, okay, you don't have to pay tax on that. Makes a lot of sense for these people who don't have any money to pay the taxes anyway. But again, that's a temporary thing designed to be temporary because it's aimed at what we hope is a short-term problem in the housing market.
Now, this is not the first time that we've done a story like this about the expiration of these particular tax credits. How has Congress traditionally dealt with this in the past? The tax credits expire, and then what?
Well, Congress tends to wait to the last minute to do these things. We actually were fortunate at the beginning of 2013 because Congress did double duty extending the provisions for 2012 and at the same time saying we'll do it for 2013 as well. And that's those tax provisions that are now expired and we have to worry about 2014. Congress deals with it on a year-to-year basis, both because of the revenue implications, the fact that it looks cheaper to do it on a year-by-year basis, as I said before, and also that the folks who benefit from these provisions lobby hard in the years that's happening, contribute to campaign funds, and it's kind of nice if you're in Congress to have folks coming and saying, asking for favors, and you can ask for favors back, I guess. But that's a political question that I, as an economist, I really shouldn't be answering.
Now, there are some businesses who say that having the tax expiration, you know, having these things expire at the end of the year and every year and then have Congress consider or reconsider or maybe not consider these tax credits creates a climate of uncertainty for business. Is that a real effect, do you think, or is that just more political talk?
I think there is uncertainty for firms, particularly on the ones that look shaky on the face of them. Does it really make sense to give a special depreciation if you're raising racehorses? And if you don't know that that's going to be renewed, then you may not invest the same way you would otherwise. On the other hand, the fact that Congress has renewed them year after year after year makes them look a little less uncertain, a little less temporary than they otherwise would be, and I expect a lot of firms act as if these will be renewed. Of course, they could be in for a shock at some point.
You know, one of the things that this brings up and is the whole idea of tax reform. And we've heard in the past year or so that, you know, well, not just the past year or so, we've heard for some time now that we need some sort of major tax reform. And then when we do stories like this, where there are these bits and pieces of things being affected and not renewed and then will be considered at some point, people always say what this really points to is a need for some sort of larger reform. Is that your thinking on this, or do you have a different viewpoint?
Well, this is only part of the need for reform. These are the pieces that expire and need to be renewed, but there's a lot of the permanent tax code that one could argue about. Do we really need the alternative minimum tax? Are all the differential rates we have the right kinds of things to have? There are a lot of permanent deductions and credits and exemptions in the tax code that we might want to fix, as well as these temporary ones. One of the things that's going on this year is debating whether we should address the expired tax provisions by themselves or whether we should make them part of a larger tax reform. And the problem with doing the latter, putting this part of larger tax reform, is it relies on getting that tax reform done. That's a much heavier lift than passing just the expiring provisions. But it's an issue. You do need a way to pass these expiring provisions. They very rarely are passed on their own. The question is what legislative vehicle do you use in Congress to get these enacted?
Given what's been happening in Congress for the last couple of years in terms of its ability to get things done, is it likely that we're going to see some sort of larger reform? Or, you know, given what just happened, you know, the sort of the baby steps in the budget deal, is now maybe the time to start taking a look at some of these things?
I think the problem with getting tax reform done right now is it is not the kind of thing you do short term, and it does require a very heavy investment from at both ends of Pennsylvania Avenue. At this point, the Congress has bought in fairly heavily into the idea of tax reform as a concept. Both Dave Camp, who's the chair of the Ways and Means Committee, and Max Baucus, who's the chair of the Senate Finance Committee, have worked hard this last year to put together plans for tax reform, and we're likely to see very specific plans coming from both of those committees this year. At the other end of Pennsylvania Avenue, the president has not put a great effort into the tax reform. And until he does invest in that and put the administration's into the equation, it's hard to imagine it ever happening. He has been rather distracted by other issues, as you might know.
And as we get closer to 2016, does it become less likely that we'll see something big happen?
Every time there's an election, there's an issue of what's going to happen. Even this year is that way, with the off-year election coming up in November, with all of Congress and a third of the Senate up for re-election. And that makes it harder. A number of people have said that either we take care of these expiring provisions early in the year or they wait till after the election. The closer you get to the election, the harder it's going to be to pass these things because they then become ammunition for opponents during the election campaign. The same thing then happens in 2016. Your president, to the extent he's going to be involved in any decisions, we'll have a lame duck president getting closer and closer to the end of his term, and the whole question of tax reform will be part of the argument, so the debate during the 2016 election.
So given all of that, how do you predict Congress will deal with these cuts this time around? Are they going to be able to do something in the next couple of months?
I think it's really hard to predict what Congress will do at this point. My guess is they'll either try to attach this to something dealing with the debt ceiling, something dealing with extending unemployment benefits for long-time unemployed, things that have to get done early in the year, or they will push them off to the end of the year. I'm hopeful that they'll do it early in the year so that they don't have it hanging like the storm of Damocles over the various taxpayers, but it's really a tough call which way it's going to go this year.
But if they let them go, they could actually make a little money for the Treasury, right?
There's quite a bit of money. It's not going to solve our budgetary problems, but there's quite a bit of money here. On the other hand, doing away with all these things, letting them stay expired, will affect both businesses and a lot of individuals adversely in ways that will not help the economy as we're still trying to recover from the recession.
All right, lots to think about. Bob, thanks so much for being with us today.
It's my pleasure.
That was Robertson Williams, a Sol Price Fellow at the Nonpartisan Tax Policy Center.
You're listening to Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Gene Purcell. There are a few universal truths about living in Wisconsin. First of all, summer's always going to be short. It's going to be cold in the winter. And Green Bay Packers tickets are always going to be really hard to get. Isn't that right?
Well, maybe not so fast on that one. As we're seeing, there are still thousands of tickets available for this Sunday's playoff game against the San Francisco 49ers. And if they don't sell soon, a TV blackout could be imposed on the game, which seems like an unthinkable possibility in a Packer-obsessed state.
And that is the topic today of our Curious Wisconsin segment, and we would like to hear from you. What do you make about this news about tickets still being available for that playoff game in Green Bay? Are you planning on enduring the cold and going to the game? And if the game does get blacked out, what are you going to do with your Sunday instead? How are you going to see the game? Give us a call at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or send an email to talk@wpr.org, and we'll be taking your calls in just a few moments.
First, we're joined by Don Walker. He's a reporter and blogger at the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel, and he writes the Business of Sports blog. Don, welcome to the show.
Thank you. Glad to be with you.
Well, it seems kind of crazy to think that thousands of tickets are still available to this game, but apparently that is the status right now. What's your reaction to all that?
Well, I am surprised as well. I heard your intro there talking about certainties in life in Wisconsin. Well, we're going to have cold weather for sure this Sunday, but it is somewhat surprising that there are tickets available, especially for a playoff game, and there are a host of factors to help explain that.
So give us a couple of those factors. My guess is the cold weather has to be at least a major portion of that.
Yeah, I agree. That is clearly emerging as one of the other reasons why people are opting to stay home in their cozy den or living room to watch the game. Latest forecasts that I've seen call for a high of below 7 at 5 o'clock Sunday afternoon. That's barely an hour and a half after the game started. So weather is clearly a big deal. But a lot of fans, season ticket holders, are also loudly complaining about a new ticket policy that was announced at a very bad time, late November. You might recall it was shortly after the Detroit Lions had really cleaned out the Green Bay Packers 40-10. The Packers' playoff prospects looked pretty bleak. The new ticket policy that was announced to season ticket holders said, we'd like you to put money in advance to reserve playoff tickets, and if the Packers don't make the playoffs, we will apply that money to next year's season ticket package. Well, some season ticket holders simply reasoned there was no way the Packers were going to make the playoffs, and they were unwilling to commit that kind of money that late in the season toward playoff tickets, so it looks like they punted and decided not to go after that. That, of course, created an excess of available ticket inventory. As much as 40,000 seats were available by as recently as Monday morning. The Packers are picking away at that, but we're still reportedly at least 5,500 seats short of a sellout.
So what do you think is going to happen? Do you think there actually will be a blackout? Is the NFL bluffing by any chance here?
Well, I don't think they're bluffing, but I've been willing to stake whatever reputation I have, and that is I see it highly unlikely there would be a TV blackout. I think the Packers, and we should know within a moment or so today whether the NFL grants the team an extension, giving them more time to sell tickets. Absent that, there's other options, I suppose. There could be a title sponsor at Lambeau Field who would agree to buy the remaining inventory, thereby ensuring a sellout and thereby ensuring that all of us who prefer to stay warm on Sunday can watch the game at home.
And a history lesson, if you would, why do we have such a thing as a television blackout anyway?
Well, this was it is a quite old rule imposed by the National Football League, and it was simply imposed in a day where they wanted to fill the stadium, and they felt it was important that the stadium be filled. And if it wasn't, then the fans be damned. And so it was, you were unable to watch a game. And, of course, those were the days, and I remember them well. People would drive 75 miles or more to find a bar, a tavern, or somebody else, some other television market, and watch the game. But most people seem to agree that in this digital era, it's an archaic rule that perhaps ought to end soon.
I got to say, you know, you mentioned the cold weather is a factor here. Isn't that what being a Packers fan is all about? You're hardy, you put on your snowsuit, you paint your face green, you put on your windbreaker, your parka.
Yeah, what happened to the ice bowl, for gosh sakes?
Exactly. Are we going soft?
Yeah, I was just about to say that. I think perhaps we have gotten a little soft. I did a little research this afternoon. The game time temperature for the ice bowl on December 31st, 1967 was 13 below. I'm not even sure they had invented wind chill at the time. But more recently, a New York Giants playoff game at Lambeau Field, it was 3 below at game time and a wind chill of 24 below. Unfortunately, the Packers lost that game, but they had a full house. But I do think the advent of, you know, high-end televisions, high-definition televisions, people get a very good game experience at home. That's why you see the Packers and frankly, any other professional sports franchise market the game experience. They want people to come to the game, obviously, to spend money. And a big house is something that they're always shooting for. But, again, some people are choosing to stay home.
Well, Don, we know you have to go. Thanks so much for being with us today.
You're welcome.
Don Walker is a reporter and blogger at the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel.
And we're taking your calls now at 1-800-642-1234. What do you think of the Packers blackout? Let's go to Joan first in Rudolph. Hi, Joan.
Hi, thanks. My comment is, I don't know if a lot of people know that the NFL League headquarters is a nonprofit organization, so another slap in the face is the American taxpayer gets to pay for, subsidize the NFL. They get all the profit for their $102 million CEO, whatever. And then the home people that subsidize the team, actually, which I believe they are taxed, but the NFL headquarters isn't taxed. They get a lot of the profit and all this thing, too. We subsidize them. We don't get to see the playoff game.
All right. So, Joan, thank you so much for calling up. Joan, hoping, obviously, like a lot of people, that the game will not be blacked out for various reasons there.
800-642-1234, if you'd like to weigh in on this. And we go to Viroqua now, and James is with us. Hi, James.
How are you doing?
I'm doing good. What do you think about all this Green Bay Packer empty seats available for the playoffs thing?
Well, you're gonna have to talk to a Seattleite. Not that I'm a Seattle Seahawks fan, but I've only lived in Wisconsin for about 6 years, so I find the whole fanaticism of the Packers pretty interesting. So I hope nobody remembers that playoff game where, well, whatever.
We remember it. Just trust me when I say that.
Yeah, no, I like the Milwaukee reporter's commentary about, you know, it's there's a lot of ways, a lot of things to do on a Sunday afternoon as far as football goes, and the whole game experience is a, you know, that's the marketing niche there, and you know, and you got a lot of things that they're fighting, like I don't know how many people are wanting to sit out minus 20 Fahrenheit or whatever, But it'll be interesting to see if they don't sell out. I think it might be a trend of the future, to be honest with you. Like the previous comment of the previous caller was that, you know, it's kind of laughable that the NFL is a multi-million-dollar operation and they don't really, well, they probably pay some taxes, but they're a nonprofit.
All right, James, thanks so much for the call. Let's go to Milwaukee now, and Ted is with us. Hi, Ted.
Hello?
Hello, Ted, you're on the air.
Hi, how are you?
I'm great. How are you?
I'm doing great. I plan on watching the game. I'm not a Green Bay Packer fan. I grew up in Minnesota. But I love playoff football. And if there is a blackout, I will be watching the game on the Internet, several peer-to-peer networks stream the game live. And you can watch pretty much any sporting event live by logging into any of the number of European peer-to-peer network.
All right, a technical solution to that, and let's go to another phone call now.
Jim in Colfax, you're up, and we've got about 10 seconds. What do you think about it?
Think, thank you for taking the call. Boo to the non-Packer fan, and I absolutely look forward to getting nice and cold and huddling up with all those Packer fans in the stadium and just having a day I will never forget going to a playoff game.
All right, excellent, Jim. Thanks. We'll leave it on that note. That's doing it for our calls today. Thank you so much for calling us up and telling us what you think. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Gene Purcell. You're with us on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Coming up later in the program, we'll hear about a proposed herb garden project in the inner city of Milwaukee.
First, as the debate over frac sand mining continues here in the state, the president of the company that wants to open a 1.5 billion iron ore mine in northern Wisconsin is being charged with contaminating an emergency water supply at a mine in Spain. Mike Simonson reports.
Antonio Ramos is the mining investigator for the Spanish Environmental Coalition called Ecologists in Action. For 13 years, he's been monitoring a string of copper mines near the city of Sevilla. He says the mines have had trouble with pollution, including the Cobre Las Cruces copper mine. Through an interpreter in a telephone interview last week from Spain, Ramos says that mining company allowed arsenic and other heavy metals to get into a water aquifer for the city of 700,000 people.
The water is used as a reserve. For Sevilla, for the city of Sevilla.
Strategic reserve.
In case of an emergency.
So no one's been injured by this?
Hasta ahora nadie se ha enfermado.
No, hasta ahora nadie se ha enfermado.
No, so far.
Now the Sevilla Ministry of Justice is moving forward with two charges against former Cobre Las Cruces general manager and current Gugibec Taconite president Bill Williams. Two other company executives not associated with GTAC have also been charged. The first charge carries up to 3 years in prison, and the second charge, 2 to 5 years. In another media interview, Williams downplayed the charges because they originated from environmental groups against mining. Ramos doesn't see it that way.
No, está equivocado, William. Dígale que me está ofendiendo y me está molestando. Con esa idea.
He says that the very offensive statement from Williams. He's fine with the mines as long as they are, you know, follow the rules.
GTAC spokesman Bob Seitz says Williams doesn't want to talk about the charges in case it does go to trial, but he says this shouldn't affect the proposed Pinoki Range open pit mine in Ashland and Iron Counties.
The process going on in Spain is a different company, a different process, a different kind of mining. What we're doing is investigating and gathering data to come up with a plan for a mining operation that would come under Wisconsin and United States law. Through the EPA and the DNR have a lot of regulations in place to protect groundwater and surface water.
But in a home video from 2 years ago posted on an anti-mining website, Williams is telling a group at the Ashland Deepwater Grill that he supports the technology used in the Cobre Las Cruces mine. You'll also hear him deny that there was any contamination from that mine. This is Williams questioned by a member of the audience.
Where are they using it?
Yeah.
Spain.
Where in Spain?
North, about 18 kilometers of Sevilla.
Cobre Las Cruces.
What's the problem?
That's the one that you had to have an outside guy come in and supervise because the water quality was so crappy.
Right. No, that's not the one. You're reading it on the wrong mind. You've got to go to the internet and open up the right stuff.
Even though Williams left Cobre Las Cruces 3 years ago, Ramos says he's culpable because he designed the system as a way to save mining costs that caused the alleged pollution.
He knows what happened when they was opening the process.
Ramos hopes northern Wisconsin won't have to go through the same battle or contamination.
Pero por favor, no permitan que hagan ahí en Estados Unidos el crimen industrial que han hecho aquí.
He is only asking that we don't do the same here. The United States, what he did there, don't allow him.
Ecology in Action legal director Isidoro Nunez says no trial date has been set and that so far all appeals have been rejected. Mike Simonson, Wisconsin Public Radio in Superior.
Mike Simonson is our Wisconsin Public Radio reporter based in Superior.
It's that time of year when New Year's resolutions are made, and for many of us, that means resolutions concerning our finances, saving more, getting out of debt, putting more money away for retirement, that kind of thing.
It does sound awfully familiar because we make these resolutions year after year, but then we wind up falling off the wagon in the weeks and months after January 1st. So how do we make sure we're setting realistic financial goals and then sticking to them?
Here with some ideas and tips is David Backey. He writes about budgeting, money management, and investing, and he's a financial contributor for the website Money Crashers. David, welcome to Central Time.
Well, thank you very much. Thanks for having me.
So it's a new year. A lot of us are making financial New Year's resolutions. At least we have some new intentions that we may want to put into play. And when we're making these resolutions, what are the pitfalls that we need to be careful of?
Probably one of the biggest pitfalls to be careful about is making your goals too aggressive. It can be real easy to do that, especially if you have a lot of credit card debt, for example. But if you're too aggressive with your goals, then you're basically setting yourself up for failure, because eventually you're going to see that you're not going to be able to reach your goal, and in that case, you run the risk of just giving up on it.
Should we be making the resolutions earlier? Is January kind of too late into the year to be making them? Is that a problem?
Actually, I don't think January's too late at all. I mean, when it comes to improving your finances, it's never too late.
Well, what are some things we can do to get our financial house in order as we head into January?
Probably the first thing to do would be to get on a personal budget. That's usually a phrase that most people aren't too thrilled about, but it's really the only way that you're going to get your financial house in order. It really doesn't take that long to set up. If you're internet savvy at all, you could use a website like Mint. That's a free budgeting website. You could also set up an Excel spreadsheet on your own. And basically what you want to do is put your income in one column, put all your monthly expenses in the other, and from there the goal is to get your spending underneath what you're bringing in.
Does it just come down to sheer willpower? What if we're not meeting our goals when it comes to that budget that we set?
If you're not meeting your goals, the best thing to do is just scale them back into goals that are actually attainable. Again, it really depends on where you're at currently with credit card debt and things of that nature. But as long as you're taking that first step, that's one of the most important things you can do. If you end up having to scale back a goal, there's nothing wrong with that whatsoever, because anything that you're doing to improve your finances, you're going to benefit from.
Another common financial goal might be something along the lines of people wanting to save more money, put more away for the rough times, for the unexpected car expense or home repair. What are the specific steps that we might take to get that accomplished?
Well, when you say save more money, that's rather a broad topic. When it comes to creating your New Year's resolutions, financial or otherwise, it's important that you make them SMART. And by that, I mean that's in the acronym SMART. And what that stands for is that the goal should be specific, measurable, attainable, realistic, and timely. So instead of just saying to yourself, this year I'm going to try to save more money, a better strategy would be to come up with a goal such as, I want to save $50 per month, each month, on all of my monthly bills. That way, it's more specific than just the broader goal of saving more money. It's something that should be fairly easily attainable, and you've got the timeliness factor to it as well.
And what's a good way? So you've got it specific. What about, you know, using an automatic transfer in your account? Is that an easy way to get it done?
That's actually a great way. I mean, even if you set it up to where you have $20 out of each paycheck sent to a separate savings account, by the end of the year, you're going to have close to $500.
Yeah, it does add up. And as long as you don't squirrel into it, little things can make a big difference, right?
Absolutely.
Well, another common resolution is dealing with debt that we have. And for a lot of people, that's overwhelming. During the recession, and especially the peak of it, I know a lot of people were working harder at getting rid of debt. So what is a good place to start there?
The best way to start addressing your debts is, again, to get yourself on that personal budget. Once you know what you're bringing in on a monthly basis, you know what's going out on a monthly basis, then you look for ways to reduce all of your monthly expenses, and there are a variety of ways to reduce what you pay on all your monthly bills and groceries as well. And once you have let's say, for example, you get yourself to where you're bringing in $100 more each month than what you're spending. From there, you just commit to devoting that extra $100 to your credit card debts until they're in the rearview mirror, hopefully for good.
Now, you said there are a bunch of different ways that we can decrease what we spend. Why don't you run us through some of those?
Well, on your monthly bills, the main ones are cable TV, your smartphone data plan, and your internet service. If you're not currently locked into a contract with your provider, there are always teaser deals going on through other providers that give you months of free service, free gift cards, lower monthly rates. The benefits really run the gamut. And if you are locked into a contract, another effective strategy to reduce your bills is to simply call in and ask for a discount. A lot of people don't know that, but with competition being so high in all of those areas, these companies will do anything to retain your business. And sometimes just by making that phone call, you can get $10 or $20 knocked off your monthly service.
So usually if you're calling one of these big companies, maybe a cable company, you get an operator who may or may not even be in your state. Are those the people you can ask for a discount, or do you have to talk to someone or ask for someone in charge in particular?
If you're not getting anywhere with the person that you originally speak with, your best bet is to ask for a manager, or better yet, just ask for the customer retention department. Those are the folks that can definitely apply discounts to your account.
Okay, customer retention department. I don't even know if I've heard that term before. I've heard of customer relations, but customer retention.
Yep, they have entire departments dedicated to making sure they hold on to their customers.
Well, we're talking about achieving our financial resolutions in the new year, and we'll pick up that conversation in just a moment. And we also want to hear from you. What are your financial goals for the coming year? How are you planning on achieving them? And if you're making financial New Year's resolutions, how are you planning on sticking with them? Give us a call at 1-800-642-1234. That's 1-800-642-1234. Or you can post on the Central Time Facebook page.
You're listening to Central Time. I'm Gene Purcell.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. We're talking about financial resolutions with David Backe. And you can join the conversation at 1-800-642-1234. That's 1-800-642-1234. You can tell us about your financial goals for the new year, and David will help you figure out how to make sure that you keep them. You can also post on the Central Time Facebook page. And David, we have an email from Roxanne in Madison who says, my financial goal for 2014 is to get out of credit card debt. I'm going to try to stop using my credit card and to pay off 10% of my debt every month. Do you have any tips for breaking the credit card habit?
Well, first of all, I'd like to say that she's definitely come up with a smart goal, because she's got it specific and she's got all the other attributes in there as well. So that's a great goal for her to have. As far as breaking the credit card habit, I'd say your best bet would be to stick them in a drawer for a month and pay for everything with cash. That way, once there's no more cash left in your wallet or your purse, then you're done spending for the month.
Oh, well, that's an interesting way to go. Cash. So would you have to take out a giant lump of cash and keep it, you know, like my grandparents did, in a lockbox or something?
Well, when I say cash, I mean you can either pay for cash or use your debit card. Because with your debit
card,
you're never going to retain any debts.
What about reassessing retirement plans? Is January a good time to start thinking about that?
January is actually a really good time to reassess your retirement plans, because one thing that a lot of people don't know about is that you can actually make contributions to your, or to most individual retirement accounts, up until April 15th of this year and have them applied to the previous year. So, for example, if now that 2013 has already passed, if you didn't get all the way up to the contribution limit, which I believe is $5,500 for last year, you can go ahead and make another contribution, get yourself up to that limit, and have it applied to the previous year.
We're talking right now about financial resolutions for 2014 with our guest David Backe, and you can join us at 1-800-642-1234, 1-800-642-1234. If you've got questions or comments or just need some advice on how to get started, our guest is here for you now. And in terms of charitable giving, that's something that obviously there's a big push for around the holidays. Now that we're sort of through the holiday season, is it still a good idea to give charitably?
As far as doing that right now, that would really depend on the current state of your finances. You know, this is typically part of the year where lots of people may not necessarily be struggling, but they just got done spending a heck of a lot of money on Thanksgiving, Christmas, New Year's, holiday gifts, entertaining friends, all of that stuff. So if you don't feel as though you can handle it right now, there's nothing wrong with waiting, because you can make your contributions at any point in time throughout the year and still get a tax break on them.
We've got an email here. This is from Tim in Cedarburg, and he says, "This year I'm trying to attack anything bringing down my credit score. I have an outstanding bill I plan to pay from a third party, and after I pay, how will I know this is no longer affecting my credit score?"
The best way to do that would be to run your credit report after that payment gets made. And actually, you can do that for free by going to the website Annual Credit Report. If you go to just about any other website, they're going to try and charge you money, and there's no need to pay money for that, because you can do it once each year for free from each of the three credit reporting agencies. I believe it's TransUnion, Experian, and Equifax.
All right, so it should happen that quickly?
It's probably going to take a little bit of time for it to post. I would say maybe 30 days afterwards, go ahead and check your report.
And what if Tim does that and he doesn't see a shift? What does it mean?
If he doesn't see that his information has been updated, the first place to go is to contact the business where the bill came from. And if he doesn't have any luck there, then there is a dispute process you can open up online with any of those three credit reporting websites.
Well, it's January 2nd, but I guess it's never too early to start thinking about our taxes. Is there stuff that we should be doing right now to get ready for taxes and get things organized and thought through?
The best way to get yourself organized for tax return time is to start preparing all of your receipts and statements and whatnot, especially regarding itemized deductions. There's lots of things that you can deduct. A couple of them are unreimbursed medical expenses, certain job search expenses, things of that nature. And if you're not currently itemizing, you may want to consider looking into that when it comes time to prepare your return, because in a lot of cases, you're leaving money on the table by simply taking the standard deduction.
Okay. And in terms of investments, let's say we want to start investing in 2014, and this is not something maybe that we've had experience with before. What's a good place to start?
The best place to start as far as retirement investing would be your employer's 401k plan. It's usually the easiest place to go to get started. Your contributions will be taken out of your paycheck before taxes, so you get that benefit. And it's also done automatically, so it's not something that you have to monitor going forward.
And what if you want to get in on the stock market and it's not necessarily for retirement and you want to invest in that sense?
Wow, investing in the stock market for someone that's never done it before, that's probably a bit of a risky option. I would tread lightly before going that route.
Maybe get a financial planner, help you figure out some safe things to do.
You should absolutely consult with a financial professional before trying to strike out on your own.
So a bunch of things here that we've talked about in terms of financial resolutions. What should we be doing to make sure that we actually stick to them and they don't just sort of fade away as the days go by?
The best way to stay on track with your financial resolutions is, first of all, to get them written out on a piece of paper. It's not going to do you much good just to come up with them in your head. They need to be written down. And keep that document handy with you some throughout the year, whether it's in your home office or somewhere at work. And then I would recommend once every 3 months or so to break that document out, see how you're doing on things, and then decide whether or not you need to scale back a goal, or if you're doing particularly well on one of your goals, you could even make it more aggressive.
Now, let's say you're trying to do something like quit smoking or lose weight. You might give yourself a little reward when you hit a goal. Is that the same kind of thing that we should be doing when we make financial New Year's resolutions?
Absolutely. Say, for example, your goal is to reduce your credit card debt by $1,000. Once you get the first $250 out of the way, there's nothing wrong with giving yourself a little pat on the back, even though that may seem counterintuitive to the topic of paying off credit card debt. It's those little kinds of rewards that are that are going to also help you stay on track to reach your ultimate goal.
What about just in general trying to be more frugal, to make do with less, and to have more of a strong financial foundation underneath us? Do you have any tips for that?
The best way to live frugally is to take an objective look at your financial life and eliminate what's unnecessary. For example, a lot of people still have a home telephone line, which may or may not be a necessity in their life. If they can get by with their mobile phone, that's $40 to $50 a month you can cross off the list. Trips to convenience stores, besides for filling up your gas tank, are generally unnecessary as well. Things like snacks and sodas, newspapers, lottery tickets. You just don't need to be spending your money on that kind of thing.
So really you're talking about just taking a hard look at things and figuring out what honestly could go if you're honest with yourself.
Absolutely. And one of the best pieces of advice I can give you as far as living frugally is every time you go to spend your money on anything, whether you're buying a bag of potato chips or you're thinking about getting a new flat screen television, is take a step back and ask yourself, do I really need to buy this? And if you answer that question objectively, most of the time you're going to come up with the answer of, no, I don't need this.
David, thank you so much for joining us today and giving us some tools to work with here.
Absolutely. Thanks for having me.
We've been talking to David Baggy. He writes about budgeting, money management, and investing, and he's a financial contributor for the website Money Crashers.